Welcome to the Insiders Insights podcast, where we share with you the thoughts of the individuals who are working for projects that are changing the world. Thank you to our sponsor, Credit Coin, the building blocks of trust. For more details, please visit the show notes below.
Welcome to Offchain Presents Insiders Insight. Today we have the lovely Sam from Zebek, who's going to discuss with us how do we make crypto more sustainable in terms of its development. But before we begin, Sam, why don't you tell our audience a bit about your journey into crypto and how did you start Zebek?
Awesome. Yeah. So thank you so much for having me. I'm Sam, founder of Zebek Protocol. I was born in Nepal during the second half of the Civil War. Grew up without seeing computer up until I was like 13 years old, saw computers, started coding, built a bunch of softwares, got introduced to Bitcoin, was involved in Bitcoin's, trading in Nepal. At some point, I started a couple of other companies, realized that, for me, the future lies in America. Came to States for education. After a semester, I started getting involved in a lot of crypto projects, tried to start a universal basic income coin, didn't work out because of the crash. Tried to start, Brex backed by USDT and died. That didn't work out either. Then later on, started working on AI software, raised a couple of $1 million. And last year, I started Zebek. And the story of Zebek is around 4 years ago, I wrote a paper on how at some point in future, money will be self-driving like cars. And it's going to be backed by smart contract. At that point, trust me, Aave Compound, they didn't have $10 billion in TVL. That time, crypto and the smart contract was very, very new thing. And no one really understood what I was talking about. But last year, when a bunch of my friends were talking things that does not make sense, one of the things we ended up talking about was payroll. Because you work for 14 days, someone pays you day 17 in US. If outside the US is actually even worse. Is you work for 30 days, someone pays you day 31. So we're like, hey, wouldn't it be great to be paid in real time so that every second you work, you're getting paid. And after research, we realized it's impossible to do that in traditional rails. You can only do this with newer rails like smart contract. And the fun thing for me is like last 4 years of my life, I've just been involved in this a lot. So that's what we're building. Zebek is a continuous settlement protocol built on top of Solana. And it enables a lot of use cases. And foremost is going to be being able to do payroll by the second, being able to pay for subscription transactions by the second, being able to do token investing by the second. It involves anything that touches with money. It converts with the traditional form of time value where 3 months, 1 month, or 6 months time period to a continuous method. We have 15,000 plus users. We have almost 50 people working in the team. We have raised almost $40 million plus. So that's a quick background in terms of me and Zebek.
Sam, you're 24. So you've been trying to start a business since how old? You were 17?
So first project that I started was when I was 15. So I tried to build a Discord. Basically, like before Discord was even there, I tried to build Slack for high schoolers. So that when you are trying to start a game or pickup games or you were trying to any gaming cohort, you can do this conversation online. I built it. No one used it because I was doing that in Nepal. So,
wow.
That's how I got into, building things. I've always been involved in trying to figure out, try to build something new. That has been my thing.
So you started Zebek whilst you were still in university?
Technically, yes. Technically I was supposed to graduate 6 months ago. No, 4 months ago. I was 23 when I started Zebek.
Oh. Damn, wow, that's amazing. So how did you manage to figure out how to raise funding and, create that network at such a young age?
So one thing I've been very, very blessed is people have believed in me. And that has I always say I have come here just standing on the shoulder of giants, right? People who saw some value in me, something in me, right? Because I was born in Nepal. I came here with $500. I didn't have anything. My parents didn't went to high school. Whenever people talk about third world, that's me and my family that they're talking about, right? But when I came here, I have always been very honest with my upbringing. I've never lied what I was and what I when I didn't know anything, I was willing to ask what it was. And I've always been open to learn, right? And people definitely saw that. And I have had a lot of mentors growing up and have taken their advice by heart. And because of that, in my last company, I pitched to 1,500 investors and 1,489 of them said no to me. That definitely helped me in terms of building a big enough network.
This was prior to Zebek, right?
Yeah, in my previous company, the AI company, it was called Asme.
And what's happened to that company? Is it still running?
Yeah, so it's in the process of being, you know, being sold. But what I realized was the product that we're building was going to be a feature, but not a company itself. So what we're doing was we're building analytics software for short video and gaming companies. So it was very, very interesting because we actually had a couple of patents. You know, we're doing in-video ads and content moderation for like scaled out, like 100 plus millions of videos at a time, right? The problem was we're not the ones who are owning the video, and the people who own the video would never pay us higher margin, right? And that kind of didn't help us because I did not have the network and also did not have that much of business learning, like business understanding myself. So great lessons.
At university, were you kind of like the odd one out when you had all of these ambitions and dreams and your classmates, what were they like? Were they like, let's go party? And you were like, no, I want to build this amazing product.
I've always been like, so I'll tell you like the stories about when I was in high school. I used to say like, you know, my first company when I was in high school, I was building, and everyone used to think that I was joking and they would make fun of me. It's like, hey, how's your $1 billion company doing? A lot of my friends used to make fun of that, right? Because they used to think that I was just like all talk, no show. And the second company was when I was in university, everyone is partying and I was there like 2 a.m., 3 a.m., like, you know, headphones on, just working. And yeah, like, you know, they used to think that like, I was just like, I was not enjoying my life. And honestly, like, I would rather not enjoy the life because the possibilities of building something new and being able to change the world is a lot more fun than just partying for a day or two.
Yeah, for sure, man, for sure. And when you were starting these companies, especially at such a young age, how did you find people to recruit? I mean, it must have been difficult to be taken so seriously, especially when you were just in university.
Oh yeah, no, those were the hard times. Like, because you don't have money, you don't have a reputation, right? I didn't have Twitter followers. I didn't have anything. And all they are listening to is your story, right? And I think the most powerful thing any founder can have is great storytelling ability, because that helps people, like, you know, rile up around you. Because I say founders are no different than nation builders, right? People like, you know, like, I'm not saying like George Washington, but like, it's the same thing like that. Like, there's Max Weber's book called like on nation building, right? Charisma and on nation building. So what he says, like, the charismatic founder, like, to be able to tell a story and to be able to have a contagious passion, right? Like, you know, like contagious energy is the most important thing. And I didn't know that. Like, I didn't know how to generate that. But when life gives you, like, you know, failure after failure, nose after nose, you just keep on telling yourself that it's there. I just have to keep working harder. And your story becomes more and more beautiful, that like, hey, I have got 1400 nos, but I'm still going after this, right? And I think that really helped, because people love when people don't give up, right? People love backing underdog. And I've always been underdog. To this day, I'm still an underdog. And I don't hesitate on telling that story, that I grew up from nothing. I came here with nothing. I didn't went to fancy university. I don't have any connection. All I have done is just people believing in me. And I ask you to believe in me as well. And that definitely resonates with people.
Wow. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Polina, do you want to share anything?
No, it's just so inspiring, you know? And I think that's why, like, startups grow so fast, because founders, they have these contagious, like, enthusiasm, as you shared. And of course, like, for me, it's also very important if I see that the founders of the project, like, they believe in it. They just, like, they go to bed thinking about that. They wake up thinking about that. And then you also want to contribute more. Like, you also want to be a part of the thing that is like going to be great, or not going to be great, but at least, like, you're having a lot of fun and you're thinking like you're doing something meaningful, because it's everybody around you, like, shares the same interest. Like, I'm enjoying hearing your story. Yeah. And, like, thinking on how many challenges you passed is just, like, unbelievable. What was, like, what was the hardest part of, especially, like, when you were still studying and you probably didn't have, like, lots of time, like, lots of free time? How could you manage it?
So at some point, I had, like, three jobs. Like, I used to work for, like different things within, like, because I'm an international student, right? I came here with a student visa. So legally, I was not able to work outside the school, right? So I had to, like, do 2 to 3 jobs so that I could pay for server costs. So I was saving every little dollar that I could. I never ate outside. Whatever school, like, gave me for food, I'm vegetarian. I don't eat anything, like, you know, fancy. So sometimes they will not have anything to, like, you know, anything nice to eat. And whatever that was, I'd survive with that to save money so that I could pay for, like, server costs or, like, domain or, like, basic little software services costs, right? That was very hard. And also the other thing was every one of your friends are going out there to work for Google and Facebook and all these different companies. And you're like, this summer I'm going to ship this product so that I can sign up Tencent, right? Or I can sign TikTok. Like, and it's like very, very hard to like, you know, relate to, because now all of your friends are just like, you know, out there partying and enjoying life, as you say, and they kind of like indirectly laugh at you, right? And to be able to convey that, like, my family are not that rich, right? And they have some expectations on, like, you know, what I am doing. And I'm saying that instead of taking a job that would pay me like $10,000 a month for like 3 months during summer, I built another software and spent $5,000 of my own money, right? So that was very hard. And on top of that, you add like all the no's that you get from investors, and hard time selling customers, because I didn't, like, when I came here, I had a thick Nepali accent, right? I did not grow up in his family that spoke English. And to be able to convince a customer, which are like people who are like 30, 40 year old people, and you are this like 19 year old kid who has a thick Nepali accent, who can build product but cannot sell their product. That all that you add all together at the same time, it's a very tough time. But honestly, it just helped me being stronger, right? Like, I don't think there's anything in the world that would make me doubt myself, because to have gone through those moments, like, I know that I can withstand a lot more, like, you know, failure than a lot of people in the world.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I'm just going to echo everything that Polina said. It's incredibly inspiring, your journey. And I do think that when you grow up in the West, well, especially me, I grew up in the UK. I think people are very privileged in terms of the way they think, and they don't understand what it means to fight for a dream and what it means to do that by yourself. You know, if you come from a background where your parents can help you, you know, achieve your dream, I don't think you take it as seriously. Like, you don't understand the repercussions of your actions. I know some individuals that have, they try to be musicians or they try to be artists or whatever, but they do it with the help of their parents' money. And, you know, I think that hampers your ability to achieve that dream, because you need to really feel that if you don't achieve this, then you can't survive. This is the only way you can do it. And at the same time, I think the way you did it, which was like, you know, I have to do this, I have to achieve this, I have to be successful, that ultimately led you to creating your baby Zebet.
Yeah, it did. And like the more sad part about this is, like, you are going through such a tough time and your family has no idea what you're talking about, right? When I'm talking about, like, yeah, the cloud bill from Google came $80,000 and we only have $87,000 in bank, my parents are like, what is that, right? That's like, those were the tough times. Like, you know, like, you don't have anyone to echo your sadness. But luckily I had great mentors, people who would just listen to me and say that, hey, it's okay. Like, you know, it's okay. Sometimes things doesn't, like, you know, like, there's a clock that you think that you're following might be the different clock than the one of that your achievements, right? Like, you know, you might move slower sometime and faster sometime, and you just have to go through it. So, you know, thank God I had a lot of great mentors and a lot of, you know, people who advised me through those tough times.
I feel for such a young person, you're extremely wise. Have you always been like this, or is this something that you've developed?
I don't know, like, the wiseness. I think I try to listen to other people, and that I think especially came from, like, you know, my family. We grew up in like the second half of the Civil War, right? And there it was always advantageous for you to listen to other people before you speak. And I think that kind of helped. And honestly, I could not have asked for, like, you know, better parents, because they actually, like, helped me, like hone that skills growing up. But yeah, and I think to be able to listen to other people before you speak has always been my thing.
Wow. I was in Nepal before the pandemic. I love this country. It's one of my most favorite countries in the world. The mountains there are just unbelievable. I wanted to ask, because you are the founder of the crypto project, and right now crypto market is going sideways, and there is a lot of FUD in the sphere, and everybody is like saying, oh, we don't know where the market is going. How do you see the biggest problem of the crypto market? How it will evolve, and what will happen in the future?
So I think we have to look into crypto in terms of the way internet evolved, right? We try to think of crypto as more of like a liquidity game. And the moment liquidity goes out of the system, we are panicking, right? It's like, oh, Bitcoin price went down to $19,000, or Bitcoin price went to $50,000. We celebrate, right? We had to look into how things went in internet. Internet, when it came out, it was just a fancy toy. But all of a sudden, people started adding economic activities within it. People realized that we don't have to use telephone to communicate. We can just have this small messaging protocol where we can send messages at a much, much cheaper cost, right? Same thing with TV, same thing with audio, video, right? So to be able to add economic activity was the way why internet survived. But if we look into blockchain, we have block space that could add, like, you know, like Solana can handle like what, like 50,000 transactions, right? Like you can have 50,000 transactions. So you have a supply of app developers developing all these different apps and all these different protocols, and you have demand of end users, right? And I think the biggest problem, or what I will still say, the existential problem of crypto right now is there is not much enough demand, because the apps that has been built are not consumer centric enough, right? There is no reason for end user to call the Solana like blockchain 50,000 times a second. I think that is like, you know, that's just for Solana, right? How many all the other blockchains that are out there? If you combine all the TPS, every single like major blockchains can do, it's less than 200,000, right? If you combine what AWS can do, AWS can do like 3 million transactions a second, just on a single, like read and write on a single, like single disk, right? So that's how the difference we are. We haven't created enough demand. And I think the biggest problem anyone can solve right now is how can we move, like, you know, activities that actually can have either consumer point of view or a real world point of view. Like, you know, if you look at internet, turns out people use e-commerce every single day. People use Facebook, Instagram, YouTube every single day, right? Or people use all those different apps every single day. We haven't created an app like that in crypto. The only app that actually, or the app or the use case that we can see as a major success point right now is USDC, or like the P2P money transfer. Besides than that, we still have not seen an app that actually required is that can make people's life a lot easier, right? On a scale out manner. So yeah, I think, like, you know, people are going to build some of those things over next 6 to 8 months. Slowly, I think we will bounce back, because as long as we have builders trying to solve that problem, right, it will be solved. Because at the end of the day, if you look at internet, revolution, it was 15, 20 people that shaped the whole internet, right? Google, Facebook, Amazon, like, there are not more than 30 companies if you really think about it. So I will say the same thing will happen in the crypto's point of view as well. Even though it's decentralized, it's going to be 30 to 40 major apps that will drive the next demand for block space. That will be the reason why all those different protocols are going to survive.
Interesting.
Do you have any ideas what those apps will be?
I wanted to ask the same thing. So funny.
So few things I can think of right now is, like, you know, I think over the time, like, a few of the governments in the world will start to have their own private blockchains, right? Where they can move things like license verification, passport verification. Those are like more of the esoteric use cases. Then we can think about the gaming use case and social media use cases, which everyone is already thinking of. But I will say there are other use cases that is blockchain is all about, like, you know, removing the inefficiencies, right? Let's think about legal industry. When smart contract first came out, people said that we will be able to move a legal contract to smart contract and we'll be able to innovate that. No one has built a decentralized legal zoom to this day. I would say that is going to be built very soon, right? Another one use case I will say is, like, let's look at machine learning. I will not name the name of the company, but one of the very major data labeling company coded another major company $3 million to label a video data, right? And the found, like, the head of the machine learning there, we spent some time to find data labeling company, and we found one in Mozambique to do the same thing for $60,000, right? And that company makes over $400 million in revenue right now. And that's just data labeling, right? Imagine we can have a distributed database of labeled data, right? Which can be shared across at a certain price, and you can train your model in a decentralized manner. That will cut down the inefficiency by what, almost 99% or 95%, right? That's a great use case for blockchain. Imagine how many, like, you know, how much of the block space, just that machine learning use case, data labeling blockchain use case alone, will fill 80% of the block space in the world right now, if we are able to, like, move all of that into decentralized manner, right? So there are all these, like, very, very targeted use cases. I think we don't have these Web2 builders moving into Web3 yet. When that happens, they will start, like, you know, researching into these specific use cases. And that will be how it's going to be creating this massive shift of the demand for block spaces.
That's interesting. So it's the democratization of information, basically. If we can create information that can be shared freely and securely, you think that's going to basically spur on the next wave of apps that are built on the blockchain?
Yeah, but even more than that is, like, these Web2 use cases, right? Web2 use cases are so inefficient, right? Centralized party means centralized party takes a large cut, right? If we take that in a decentralized manner and give out
almost... You mean Web2, not Web3?
Yeah, exactly. Like Web2 use case, like LegalZoom, right? LegalZoom takes all the profit to themselves. imagine distributing almost 95% of that back to the lawyers who are participant here and the people who are actually using the platform alone, right? How much of an economic activity it will be able to drive up. The machine learning use case is another one, right? We can just think about so many use cases, right? Where we can actually start taking things in a decentralized manner. And yes, we are still on the protocol building phases where we are doing things like DIDs, decentralized data storage, all this different type of stuff, but use cases are still not being built. And I think the reason behind is Web3 founders are people like me, right? 23-year-old people, guys who don't have that much of understanding of the real world economic activities. I think the people who are like 30, 35, who have few gray hairs, who knows about these various different economic activities with margin opportunities, like, you know, once they're able to take those business with inefficiencies and put it on Web3, that's only when we will see this massive influx of you know, block space demand.
Sam, I have a question for you. It is actually regarding a series we had with a protocol known as BSN. Well, they're not a protocol. They're sort of an initiative. And basically, this BSN, what they're trying to do is create a public chain that is not involved with crypto. So there is no coin that is created by this blockchain, because they say that in order to do what you're saying, which is to bring all of Web2 technology into this new world, there needs to be a decentralized database. But the problem with crypto is that it is too speculative. And rather than have the nodes owned by, you know, random people, these nodes are then basically owned by companies that would want to be involved in this new decentralized space. What do you think about non-crypto related public chains? Do you think that they are a waste of time, or do you think the industry may move in that direction?
I think, like, you know, like, token really is just a way of, like, you know, quantifying economic activities, right? Speculation exists over the short run, right? Over the long run, speculation will be priced in by market. I think without token, it can also be done, right? The question is, how do you distribute the economic act? Like, you know, the participants, like, reward for the participant back, right? That's kind of the, like, the idea is, the moment I hold American dollar, I'm basically saying that I am betting an American economy. When the American economy goes up, my dollar value goes up. And when American economy goes bad, my dollar value goes down, right? When I am participant of this network listing, I don't know that much about BSN. I feel like, you know, we have had Hyperledger and all this different tokenless blockchain that was built on the, like, you know, in 2017, 2018, that was a big thing, right? The question is, how is economic activities, like the revenue from the economic activities captured, right? And how does that impact on the participant's point of view? Right? Like, how is participant being rewarded for that? And I think token really helps because, yes, in the short term, there is a speculation, but with enough decentralization and with enough revenue and things like that, over the long run, you will start to see lesser volatility.
Yeah, I agree. I think that tokens basically revolutionize capitalism. I'm a capitalist. In fact, I'm a libertarian. And all of these issues that the left has with capitalism, I think, get solved by this issuance of tokens, because then you can get rewarded as a participant. You don't have to be a shareholder. You just have to be a stakeholder, someone who cares about the success of whatever you're using. Then you get rewarded because we have these tokens. Whereas in a single exchange of value economy, that is really impossible to do.
Exactly. And I think I forgot the name of this economist. I'm pretty sure it was like this French economist. Let me think about that name. He basically said that, you know, by the virtue of exchange, one man's prosperity is beneficial to all others, right? And to be honest, that actually has completely been captured out in kind of like the traditional form of capitalism, the stock market point of things, right? The only way that is, like, you know, that original idea of capitalism is possible is only in this whole token-based economy. Because here, when someone, you know, exchanges tokens, someone participates in the network, someone goes and tweets about this product, every person is actually being rewarded, right? And I think that's kind of what we need. And I absolutely agree towards your point that we should have a better models. And honestly, like, you know, things that the internet economy is this coming out, and I will say, like, over 30, 40 years time period, this might become more and more of a reality.
Do you think we're going to see, there's a new protocol called Lens Protocol made by founders of Aave that's trying to democratize social media. Do you think that can succeed? Do you think there is a space for Web2 and Web3 to coexist? Or do you think Web3 is going to eat Web2? Because it can be superior.
Web3 definitely can be superior, right? But the problem is, like, there has been enough money that has already gone to Web2 that it would not die out anytime soon, right? And the problem I see with Web3 is founders are not invested for long enough, right? With 3 years token vesting and an ability to sell the token without any, you know, any purview of like any person, that kind of like enables founders to be a little more naughtier than the Web2. And I would say, like, at the end of the day, we need this generation defining founders. In Web2, we had the generation defining founders like Jack Dorsey, Travis Kalanick, like, you know, Travis from Uber, like, you know, founders of Airbnb, Amazon's founder. Like, we can name 30 founders that changed the whole world, right? And I would say those people are still working in their companies. They were for 10, 20 years, right? We need to see similar type of commitment on the Web3 side of things. People who are going to work on the project, even only when they hold 3% of token, because they know that one day this protocol will be worth like trillions of dollars, right? I don't think any founders are thinking in that point of view, and nothing wrong with that. I would say, like, you know, it's very, very perfectly fine, because that's how like the code is a law, and that was written in the code, like, you know, alone. But for now, I think Web2 will still be like, you know, bigger part. Slowly, they might coexist. And if we see this generation defining founders, we will start to see, like, you know, Web3 eating up Web2.
What do you think is going to happen to our traditional way of valuing organizations like stocks and bonds when Web3 and tokens become more prominent? Do you think they will just coexist? I mean, if I'm creating a project, I may be issuing token and I may be issuing equity. But when we're in 10 years time, 20 years time, do you think that's still going to be the same dynamics, or do you think it's going to change?
I forgot like how many percent, but almost like 80-90% of, like, you know, Gen Z wants to hold token, right? Because they love crypto. And you add this whole concept to our sustainability, the idea of ESG, we would start to see a generation who do not care about stockholders. They will start to care about stakeholders, right? And as you previously mentioned, like, you know, the traditional, like, you know, the NASDAQs of the world do not value stakeholders. Yes, they have started to, but we will start to see the people who grew up in Compound and Aave compared to people who grew up in Bank of America. And when that generation will start to come in, we will start to see people who actually would care about stocks, and they will start to think about, like, what has been the, like, how much percentage of the revenue of the protocol was distributed back to the stakeholders, right? What is the decentralization layer? How centralized, like, you know, control of the platform is there? Like how smooth is the governance of the protocol, right? And how much they care about giving back? How do they support other up and coming companies? People will start to think about things like that, and I think that is the most exciting. I honestly would want that future, because that is very exciting. That empowers people.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the only obstacle would be the legal framework. I mean, you'd need protection, right? If you're running these protocols, you'd need the law to protect you and give you the same rights as if you started up a company. But I don't know if that will ever change. Do you think we can force it to change?
So I think the legal framework, right? Like, you remember the time back in early internet days, American government wanted to ban encryption. And now they made it compulsory. Like, you cannot actually share, like, you know, data of, like, across internet without encryption, right? So I just say, give it a time. Give it some time, and I will say growing pain. Like, people who are not people who are not able to hear the music will say the people who are dancing crazy, right? That's kind of what's happening right now. People like you and me are able to listen to the music, and the regulated people who are designing the regulation of the things, they are not able to listen to the music. And that's why they think that we are crazy. And that's why they are trying to come up with all this regulatory framework. But over the long run, they will realize that this is what they've been preaching. This actually is the American dream. This is actually the idea that all this economics, like, you know, if you think about from Marx to Smith to everyone, always have designed about something like this. The only fear for these governments are they're not the one who are in central, but they were never supposed to be, right? That was the idea of capitalism, right? And I think that's what we should be excited about. And I think slowly that's going to change. We just have to give it time. And again, I might be very, very wrong about it, but that's the hope I have for the future.
Yeah, exactly. Especially like kids who are growing up right now and they're playing like Roblox and they're using like crypto to buy like new skins in the computer games. I had a conversation with a 7 years old, and she is like very well aware about all game economy. When I was playing with probably like some dolls or like in the sand pit, you know, and it's just the different generations growing up. And I think they will see more use of the crypto, and they will be more accustomed to using different cryptocurrencies for different things, and we are going to see more adoption because there are going to be more demand because there are going to be more people for using it. So these things are all interconnected. Anyhow, it was lovely to talk to you. Like, Sean, do you want to conclude?
Yeah, this is the off-chain podcast, Sam. So the way we like to end this podcast is to basically ask our guests, what do they do in their off-chain time? So when they're not working, when they're relaxing.
Yeah, so like my life is not that exciting. I just like to write and read things. I've always been a big, I used to write stories growing up, write stories and poetry. That has kind of evolved into writing more my ramblings on future of economy, future economy and things like that. Definitely I'm trying to get sun every once in a while, but for now it's been writing new things and just hoping that some of the things that I write come true in future.
Where can we find those writings?
Where is your blog?
Yeah, I'm slowly actually thinking of actually like publishing a book, you know. That's why like I'm little old school, you know. So that's why probably sometime in a year I'll publish a summary of all these different writings I have.
Wow, awesome, Sam. Oh. Yeah, awesome, Sam. Okay. Well, I think that we're gonna leave it there. Thank you for being part of this podcast. Thank you, Paulina, for co-hosting. And we'll put all of your social medias and all of the website links below in the show notes. It's been an honor. All right, so we're gonna leave it there. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next episode. Bye, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Inside is Insight podcast is meant for informational purposes only and should not be considered as financial or investment advice. Nothing expressed in this podcast should be construed as a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any financial products. Information expressed by the host or guest of this podcast does not necessarily reflect any views of our sponsors.